Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And today we're talking to Dr. Richie Shoemaker, who has published 8 books entitled, the newest being Surviving Mold. He has recently authored a paper entitled Research Committee Report on Diagnosis and Treatment of Chronic Inflammatory Response Syndrome Caused by Exposure to the Interior Environment of Water-Damaged Buildings. And boy, is this subject apropos in the wake of devastating hurricanes in Houston and in Florida and in the Caribbean, because we're going to see a lot of folks who survived the hurricanes, seemingly unscathed, who are going to come down sick, unfortunately. And we laid out the scenario in part one for how that might occur. So who might be a candidate for biotoxin exposure? You know, how are they going to get properly vetted and diagnosed if they can't all individually see an expert like you?
After Hurricane Katrina devastated New Orleans and all that, I was sent down by Senator Kennedy's Health Education and Labor Group to look to see what was going on at post-hurricane in February of 2016. So it was about 5 months after the injury, and we were able to look at people who were on a boat. A carnival ship boat was parked up the road from where I was in Violet, Louisiana. We were in St. Bernard's Parish next to the Ninth Ward, and it was very clear that the people who had an illness had symptom groupings that would not hide. They had a mean number of symptoms that was over 18 out of 37 that I asked routinely. Mm-hmm. We used a handheld visual contrast sensitivity test that shows a distinctive deficit with exposure to biotoxins. VCS has been used for years. It's probably the most widely used test for functional vision that there is.
And what is it? It's just a little handheld device. I've seen it, I've seen you lecture and I've seen what the device looks like. And it's something which simply tests people's visual perception, right? And their ability to discern contrast.
We're looking at the neurologic function of vision. And so we're not looking at rods and cones in the back part of the eye. We're looking at the optic nerve itself. There are fibers in the optic nerve that carry near vision, far vision, color, static, motion vision, and then contrast. Contrast is the ability to see an edge of black opposed to so different color, a shade of gray, black opposed to white. And contrast is what we rely to recognize other objects. And when we have an injury to contrast, the blacks fade to gray, the whites fade to gray as well. And there is a time of extinction that is seen prematurely in a lower ambient condition with visual contrast that gives a pattern that if we graph the ability to see with biotoxin illnesses, the ability to which gray against gray appears is much lower than what it is for normal people or other people with other illnesses. But having said that, if all we look at are groupings of symptoms and visual contrast, having done the statistics in 10,000 plus patients, we know that the likelihood of making an error, the sum of false positive and false negative, leaves us with a 98.5% accuracy combining with symptom clusters and visual contrast to determine who's got an inflammatory response syndrome. Your allergy patients will not have this. Your post-traumatic stress syndrome patients will not have this. Your depressed patients will not have this. But VCS gives a portable, inexpensive, reliable diagnostic marker that was the first one we ever had back in the 90s.
And my understanding is this is not a test of your what's going on in your eyeball. It's actually a test of what's happening in your brain. Your visual cortex is right.
Exactly. Okay. You understand exactly completely the correlation between abnormalities and visual contrast and then abnormalities of blood flow and capillary beds gave the first clue to the mechanism of injury of capillary hypoperfusion. So when you start saying, I'm not going to give oxygen to cells the way they are, supposed to get, then you're going to say, wait a minute, if every cell is getting induced blood flow, and it is, what's going to happen to the mitochondria, the energy sources, the powerhouses of these cells? They're going to be compromised too. And that problem gets compacted or compounded by the fact that the DNA for mitochondria is not just in the mitochondria itself. It is copied and is part of our own DNA, where it's subject to the abnormalities in what we call transcriptomics of our own genes. So here we have people starting to develop symptoms. They know they're exposed to a stew with countless things in them that could be making sick. But meanwhile, visual contrast starts to drop. That's telling you it's biotoxin. And then we start seeing the complications of reduced exercise tolerance, mm-hmm. as shown by inadequate presentation of activity. When people can go up steps and they never were tired before, now they are, they're developing problems with generating ATP, but they're also developing a problem with increasing pressure from the right side of the heart to the lung. Mm. So pulmonary artery pressure increases, and if In Katrina, there were only three doctors within, 150 square miles. I don't know how many.
And very few recognize this with your level of sophistication. What are some measures that people can undertake in terms of self-care? And then, of course, let's get into the specialized care that you might administer to people who come to your practice or to consult with you.
In disaster situations where we don't have a lot of physicians available, if power is restored, a computer can help. Take the visual contrast test. The visual contrast test is well supplied by survivingmold.com. The symptom rosters are included.
So there's a self-test at survivingmold.com?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
We've
so
correlated
that's
that
news that people can use
over and over again. But you have to have power. They won't help you in Puerto Rico.
Okay, right.
But the issue
once power
then
is restored.
Is to say, all right, I know I've got to get in within a couple of days, and I've got to cut out the bottom 3 feet of drywall and remove all the insulation, mm-hmm. and getting rid of building materials, that's all fine. But there must be adequate ventilation when you're doing that emergency decontamination, because as soon as you open that drywall area up, out comes Pandora's box of particulates of inflammagens and toxins that you breathe, and now the illness is off to the races. So it's a race to get cleaned up before you get nailed so bad by what you're cleaning.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And is it desirable if you're engaged in this kind of cleanup, if you're a homeowner or perhaps you're a contractor who's been hired to do some mold abatement, to use a respirator, certain types of masks help prevent exposure? What's the deal?
What's being passed out now is just a damn shame. And those are painter's masks.
No, they will
do absolutely no good. We're looking for things to remove particulates smaller than 3 microns, and indeed smaller than 0.3 microns.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the N95 mask that NIOSH wants you to use, they'll be glad to give you one, provided you read a 42-page manual of instruction on how you're supposed to do it, and there's got to be a physician to do a physical exam to say you're able to wear that. And I said at one conference, what are we looking for physicals to say you can wear a mask?
Yeah.
Well, we don't know. You're on your own.
It's a liability thing because maybe it restricts breathing. They don't want people to conk out, I guess.
Well, in any event, if you say a physical exam is required, you can't get a mask until you get the exam.
Yeah.
Who's going to get a mask?
Exactly.
So N95 means that 5% of particulates get through. It's a little misleading. The carbon filters don't add very much at all. We're looking at the need for ventilation and N95 if you can do so. Tyvek suits when it's 95 degrees out, or if you've ever worn one, Dr. Hoffman, they're no fun.
Yeah.
So anyway, the poor folks are trying to get things dried out. They're getting sprayed. They're wading through. I think there's 11 different Superfund sites.
Yep.
Who knows what was burning nearby with the peroxides. So it's just, a nightmare. But after we have power, then we can start to dehumidify areas that are controlled indoors. Once you've got windows put back in, and you can have the open walls, but you want to be able to isolate the interior environment from the exterior environment. Because when you do that, then there are devices. HEPA filters are extremely useful. They'll filter out things down to 0.3 microns. The AeroOasis oxidizing compounds are godsends in cases like this. They're not expensive. I have no financial interest in them. There's no conflict of interest.
Well, what are those? Those are things you spread around the house, or they're
these compounds are small. These devices are small. They're portable. Mm-hmm. They do run on electricity, so you've got to have power. But they will release oxidizing elements that will bind to VOCs, that will bind to bacterial endotoxin, and bind to particulates smaller than 0.3 microns.
Okay.
So if you've got an aeroasis going and you've got a HEPA filter, use the cheapest one that you can find, you can get ahead of the particulates. But then the question comes, since fungi are not living in you, that's not the illness,
right?
It is inflammation from the particulates of this stew. Now, the real issue is that mycotoxins are about 1% total of the problem, 1%. You're going to hear people saying 90%. That's wrong. That's just plain wrong. By all means, bacteria and actinomycetes together with of fragments of microbes are what make people sick. Here's where, unfortunately, things available over the counter that have been used, and clay and charcoal and chlorella and all these different things, they just don't work.
Internal use, like for internal detoxification.
I'm going to eat some charcoal. That'll help me feel better.
And
there are some people that, especially in alternative medicine, think it's a good idea. Having looked at that and published on that, I can tell you it doesn't work. Some people say, I feel great. Well, good. That's fine. Let's take 100 of you and let us see the results of the our objective data so we can make recommendations for 1,000 of you. It doesn't hold.
And the people who, you know, they wash the walls down with bleach, that's delusional, right? I mean, if you have any moisture that's actually penetrated your drywall, your furniture, your, you know, flooring, the bleach, you know, is supposed to neutralize the mold and kill everything off. Is that a good idea?
No, and the reason it's not is most people are using the proper 10% dilution of bleach. So it's mostly water. But the 10% dilution of bleach is not going to kill what's already dead. 99.8% of the things that make people sick inside of a home are fragments. They're
dead,
chemical
dead fragments, you know, of what was what
mannans,
previously grew.
Beta-glucans, hemolysins. You can't kill those things. They're zombies. They're already dead. So the idea of killing something is misguided. I've seen a lot of ads for people selling things that'll do that. The real issue is that we can get great benefit by using quaternary ammonium pounds. And it sounds fancy. Quats. Oh, man. Give me some quats. Well, where do you find quats? When your grocery store sells you Fantastic and Formula 409 and even Windex is related to quats, you can spray these materials on areas and wipe them off and remove not only living organisms, however few there might be, but also the dead ones and the fragments as well.
Okay.
So we're looking to see inexpensive, readily available materials. So as we go forward, the question then comes, how can we deal now with spores that have been germinating inside HVAC once we're going to turn on the air conditioning system?
Yeah, that's a whole that's a whole ball of wax because people think, wow, it's great, I get back inside with the air conditioner. Meanwhile, that air conditioner has been saturated in moisture for days and days and days without power. That could be a huge hazard.
One of the things that is compounding that hazard is that as we've gotten more sophisticated, I guess, with our home construction, more and more HVAC ductwork is made out of flexible fiberglass. It's less cost than sheet metal. It's easier to put up, quicker to run. You don't have to worry about attaching one section to another.
I had that in my house, and it was a nightmare. We had to tear it all out. It was just impregnated with gunk.
The interesting issue is that the gunk that comes out of droplets are droplets, as you already have said, are so small we can't see them. But here's a little fiber sticking out the middle of the airstream, and a little bit of dust will stick to it, and then a micro droplet sticks to the dust, and now a spore comes along, grows on top of that developing water source and food source. The microbe grows, and they grow internally. They grow into the middle of that ductwork and release their products from the middle outwards. So it's this ebb and flow of what goes on in ducts, and the answer is get rid of it.
And use metal ducts is preferable.
When you use metal ducts, you've got to glue each of the sections one to another, then they're screwed, and then the ductwork that I use, or the duct tape I use for my Christmas presents, I guess I'm a little odd about wrapping, but it's not the same as what you use on ductwork in your home. The ductwork these days is about 12 inches wide and is almost impregnable for air. So once you're glued, screwed, and then wrapped, then you insulate that ductwork. Well, that's going to stop the duct from sucking air from the outside world into your problem inside the air in your home.
Yeah, because you need a secure system. So what, you know, there are many measures that people can undertake, and I presume you outlined some of them in your book, and because we can, you know, we can detail them, or people can go purchase Surviving Mold, which is available through your website at survivingmold.com, correct? But what can you outline? I know it's complex, and these patients are very challenging because I've seen some of them. What can be done for someone who has already had that exposure? Their immune systems have been triggered. That process has been underway for a while, the process you describe in part one, you know, transforming, you know, cytokines and, you know, hormonal changes. How do you bring these people back to some sort of equilibrium?
What I've done over the years is a lot of trial and error. I need to be upfront with that. When I got started, all I had was a toxin binder called cholestyramine. Gave it to people that had terrible diarrhea and six or seven other health symptoms. I said, I've not fixed any of these other things from Fisteria. That was the problem in the Pocomoc River and all through the Chesapeake Bay. Mm-hmm. But I gave them cholestyramine and the diarrhea went away. Well, you and I both used that to treat bile salt malabsorption for a long time.
Yeah, it's a bile sequestrant. It helps to pull the toxins out through the gastrointestinal tract, right?
It prevents their reabsorption is how it works. But anyway, what cholestyramine did early on for me, when I gave it to someone with terrible diarrhea, they came back 3 days later, yep, my diarrhea is all gone, I feel fine, but my cough went away, my headache stopped, and I felt, and off to the races. 200 patients later, I wrote the first paper of acquisition of Fisteria in the wild, then down to blue-green algae blooms in Florida, and more diagonal blooms and ciguatera. It's been an interesting 20 years. My first mold patient was in 1998, and all I had was cholestyramine. And they had what turned out to be stachy growing all over the inside walls of a closet, and right above it was an area there was a roof leak where the flashing was bad right beside the chimney. So in order to get that person better, they had to stop water intrusion, they had to remove the building materials, and they had to decontaminate the reservoirs of the home. The reservoirs are in the air, on the walls, and on the ceilings, together with their possessions. That's what the person is doing. Meanwhile, the internal milieu is that without toxin carriage being interrupted, and cholestyramine, and Welchol is the only other drug that will work, by the way. They're both used to lower cholesterol.
Yep.
They're both covered by insurances. But if you take those and you have a short-term illness, you're not going to have the massive complications of longer-term illnesses that gives the brain injury, that gives the irreversible genomic situation. The proteomics of a short-term, less than 3 months case are almost disarmingly simple. And most of the time, all you need is cholestyramine. But having said that, having worked with those sicker people for years, it was pretty obvious that cholestyramine, which does have GI side effects,
it really is tough to tolerate for a lot of patients.
And in addition to being tough to tolerating, there gets to be this whole nausea factor of I've got to wait 30 minutes after I take it before I can eat something, before I can take a medication. So that's why a tablet Welchol has kind of taken over most of the cholestyramine market. It's taken with food. It's so much easier along that way. But then the next step is that if people have HLA-based susceptibility and their regulatory neuropeptide MSH falls, the chance of them having within 1 month of a biofilm-forming Marcons, multiple antibiotic-resistant coagulase-negative staph, deep in their nose, is about 80%. And early on, by 2002, we had shown that if you don't eradicate this thing, and you have to wait for cholestyramine for a month before you can try to eradicate it, if you don't eradicate it, you're not going to get better. We now know why. This organism makes a whole series of compounds that it releases without causing health symptoms. You can't tell you got a Marcons by a headache or a runny nose or a sneeze. You can tell Marcons by a culture that's done with an API staph technique. Microbiology DX, their phone number up in Boston, is 781-276-4956. 781-276-4956. I'm not related to that group either.
This is a nasal swab that determines the presence of this organism that creates a biofilm.
Right. And if they will send you everything you need for the culture, your doctor needs to order the test. He just needs to register. It's a one-page form. It's not a big deal. But when you eradicate that organism, in days gone by, we could use a combo spray, Bactroban, EDTA, and gentamicin, which was just fine until people started using antifungals in the nose, and suddenly nothing would kill these organisms. Mm. So now we use EDTA and then a colloidal silver.
And EDTA 21. Is the thing used in chelation therapy, but it also seems to have the ability to break up biofilms kind of nicely.
You are right on the button. Yeah. Exactly right. The old-fashioned use of silver is in a resurgence. At 21 parts per million, it becomes bactericidal for a huge number of organisms, including fungi, by the way.
Uh-huh.
But specifically, we use that for 3 months. And the fascinating thing is that what we do with EDTA colloidal silver, and you can get that at Hopkinton Drug. They're another one that I've nothing to do with. They're 800-439-4441. They're up in Boston as well. But with EDTA and with colloidal silver, the culture will stay positive mm-hmm. for several months, but the genomic activity is knocked down in about 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
The fascinating issue is that, especially in alternative medicine where people are using a lot of substances and making some ideas based on a belief and assumption, we can use genomics to show ribosomal gene attack and mitochondrial gene attack that must be cleared. And what's attacking mm-hmm. the ribosomal genes are compounds called ribotoxins. And Dr. Hoffman, I don't know how much you think about evolution, but just imagine that what I'm going to tell you is true, and it is that every living creature, whether it's a protozoa or an orangutan, or whether it's a man or it's a willow tree, it doesn't matter. They all have two subunits of ribosomes, and in the middle is the sarcin-ricin loop. That is the site where proteins are elongated one amino acid at a time. This is a vulnerable structure. It's long and slender, and the little tip has an adenosine moiety on it. And the protein must be moved through that moiety in order to make proteins. If we look at what these organisms do, whether they're fungi or bacteria or dinoflagellate, they make compounds that knock out mitochondrial production of energy,
mm-hmm.
and they make compounds that knock out ribosomal production of proteins.
So you get impaired protein synthesis throughout your body in every single organ, every single function.
And then you don't have mitochondria available adequately to replace that energy mm-hmm. loss.
Mm-hmm.
25% of the energy of a cell is used in ribosomal right. function.
So
you have 1,000 more ribosomes in a given cell.
So do you support your patients with certain vitamin regimens? Because that's a popular avenue for some doctors engaged in detoxification protocols to rev the detox pathways with antioxidants, for example, or support the mitochondria
nothing.
With coenzyme Q10, things like that.
Do absolutely nothing. I don't mind CoQ10. There's about 8 or 9 CoQs, by the way. 10A and 10B get mm-hmm. a lot of attention. But the real issue is you don't replace 3, 4, 6, and 7. And, you know, 10's not going to do you much good. The issue is that this is not a situation where vitamin helps.
Mm-hmm.
This is a toxic injury to a structure with a genomic basis. And a vitamin is not going to turn off gene production.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the big problem is that many people think that a SNP,
yeah.
looking at MTHFR and things like that, makes a difference clinically. I'm going to tell you that SNP does not tell me anything whether it's active or not. Transcriptomics will tell me about differential gene activation
mm-hmm.
and look to see the physiology of gene abnormalities compared to controls. SNPs don't tell you if they're active. You can't compare a SNP to a control and conclude anything if you don't know activity.
No, you know, I agree. I think that the genotyping and genetic testing is overblown because often they come up with these lengthy vitamin protocols based on gene interpretation. And where the rubber meets the road in terms of patient response, it's a very iffy. So,
Well, you're polite to say iffy. I'd be a little more direct. I think that's exactly the wrong thing.
I'm diplomatic about it. So bottom line, it's about detoxification. And it's also about eradication of some of these opportunistic infections, we can call them, that develop in the wake of exposure. I think that kind of sums it up, although you have a very refined approach.
If you call it colonization, then we'll be on the same track. An infection means invasion. These organisms sit on the mucous membrane surface and throw rocks at particulates that are floating around in the bloodstream. Mm-hmm. There's a series of events. In the end, we correct one abnormality of the 11 classes that we've got to correct at a time. And only then, when we have corrected the first 10, do we get to the answer of now doing the genomic correction. This illness stems from abnormalities of gene activity. We have come a long way in 20 years. We used to think it was mycotoxins, that was wrong. We used to think it was infection, that was wrong. We used to think it was proteomics alone, that was wrong. It is all of the above, and then differential gene activation. Once we restore gene to activity to normal, and whether we call the illness chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia or depression that's not responsive to antidepressants or not, if we look at the biomarkers that have been taught to us by the chronic inflammatory response syndromes and correct them, we now finally can use a four-letter word for our patients. I've not been able to use it much at all for 22 years. The word's called cure. Getting to the genomics, the basis of the illness. You show me one diagnostic parameter, one objective parameter that separates fibromyalgia from controls. Good luck.
Show me one objective parameter.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then I come along and I say, I'll show you 20 objective parameters. Then I'll show you genomics. And as soon, Dr. Hoffman, as you learn genomics, your time as the old Dr. Hoffman is over. Because when you see the beauty, this is the universe through a Hubble telescope and not just a little play toy that we look at on Earth.
And that's the direction I think that precision medicine is going. So a lot of this is outlined in your book, which is Surviving Mold. So what's our take-home message for today? What are some resources that people can turn to? And tell us a little bit about your practice as well.
My practice, since I've retired from actually treating patients, is pure consultant. Mm-hmm. My job is to train physicians. We've got about 30 that have been certified, another 100 or so that are in the pipeline. Surviving Mold has got about a million pages of documents on there. I'm not kidding you. There's a lot there.
Okay.
What we pride ourselves on, that everything we do has been peer-reviewed and published. You're not going to see any tolerance for assumption. You're not going to see any tolerance for guess. What we want is to do things that are going to work in populations of people. The protocols themselves are complex. They do require lab testing each step along the way in the best of all possible worlds.
And so you will actually find a list of physicians, since you're not in active practice, there are physicians regionally. They're few and far between, but there are physicians who are acquainted with this methodology, are comfortable treating victims of mold exposure and biotoxin exposure, multiple chemical sensitivity, who are trained in this paradigm, and they're listed at the website at survivingmold.com. Is that correct?
That's right. Click from the homepage on the Certified Physician section. You will see discussions of my protocol written out by every one of the certified docs. So if you want to know what do you do, how do you do it, well, here it is. It's written for you 25 times. And the doctors that are using the protocol are listed on the site, and you can find somebody. And even if all you do is reach somebody to talk to on a phone, as medical care is gearing back up in Houston, and it is, you can still have the same abnormalities done. Now, the one thing that was fascinating to me is that for years, NeuroQuant, this FDA-cleared software program that shows in 10 seconds what's post-Lyme syndrome, what's PTSD, what is traumatic brain injury, what is mold problems, we didn't have a single NeuroQuant in Houston until right after the hurricane. And that was one of the first MRI facilities that opened up. Absolutely fascinating.
So I don't quite get your drift. That you're saying that bespeaks a lack of preparation or lack of interest in helping people in this fashion?
without NeuroQuant, people would have to go to Austin or Dallas or San Antonio from the Houston area. But as soon as Houston started recovering, people involved in MRI recognized the utility of NeuroQuant as an effective, rapid diagnostic test, and now they
In other words, to spot the people who need help. I get it. Okay.
The diagnosis solution was instilled only after the hurricane.
Right. Right. Well, okay, belatedly, you know, hopefully a lot of people will become aware of this, and we'll seek appropriate help, and, you know, we extend our sympathies to the victims, because the challenges that they have to face are pretty near insurmountable. It's a very, very toxic stew, and you've been helpful, Dr. Shoemaker, in explaining what's going on. Congratulations on your pioneering work. Really appreciate it. Once again, the website is survivingmold.com. Is that correct?
www.survivingmold, yes, sir.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for having me. I really appreciate your excellent comments and questions. That was fantastic.
Great. I really enjoyed talking to you.
All right.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.